Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hello, my name's David Runciman, and this is Past, Present, Future. Today's bad idea really is a very bad idea. I'm talking to the historian, the preeminent historian of modern Germany, Chris Clark, about anti-Semitism. It's long and complicated history. Where does it come from? Why does it keep coming back? And why is it so weird? Chris, we're not here to talk about whether anti-Semitism is a bad idea. I think we can agree it is a bad idea. This is a conversation about the history of that bad idea, and particularly the ways in which it recurs. Full disclosure, maybe because it's a sensitive topic, I am Jewish in the sense that my mother is Jewish, though I wasn't raised Jewish, and I don't have personal experience of anti-Semitism. You come from a Catholic background, but this is not that podcast. So there is a podcast called, a new one, called A Muslim and a Jew Go There. This is not A Catholic and a Jew Go There. This is a conversation with a historian about history. But we will come up to the present, and we will talk about Israel at the end. But I want to go all the way back to the Middle Ages, to the early modern period. Anti-Semitism is a feature of European history in so many different ways. Maybe to start with, you could just say something about, could be the medieval period, could be the early modern period, but what makes anti-Semitism different, given that was a world which was rife with discrimination, persecution, violence, all sorts of different groups were subject to all sorts of appalling treatment in all sorts of different kinds of regimes. And yet there is something distinctive about anti-Semitism in a way there always has been. Do you have a sense of what it is that makes anti-Semitism in this origin story a distinctive form of discrimination? Seems too mild a word for it, but I'm going to call it discrimination.
I think it is distinctive. I mean, it's distinctive in lots of different ways and for lots of different reasons. But one key point of exceptionality, I suppose, is the unique position of Judaism as the sort of originating religion for two other world religions. Christianity and Islam both grow out of the, you know, they are both Abrahamic faiths. So I think that places the Jews or Judaism, the phenomenon of Judaism, in a kind of hinge position, which is unique. I mean, there is no other, I can't think of any other religion which is in this sort of position. I don't think necessarily we should talk today about the history of anti-Semitism in the Middle East or in the Islamic world, although that is a history in its own right, a very interesting and varied one. But if we confine our gaze for the moment to the Christian West, then that position of Judaism as the origin, the predecessor, is very fraught and quite complex and creates deep ambivalences. On the one hand, you know, veneration for the Old Testament, out of which the New Testament springs, and Christ is in many ways the fulfillment of Scripture, meaning of Old Testament Scripture or of Mosaic Scripture. That's how he sees himself, and that's how his followers see him. On the other hand, in some ways, Christ replaces Judaism. He replaces the circumcision in the flesh with the circumcision of the heart and produces a new dispensation, a new covenant, a new deal with God. So then the question arises, well, if there's an old deal and a new deal, what's the status of the old deal now? If there's a new one, does that mean we can rubbish the old one? We can forget that? That's problematic because that would mean that God initially made an alliance with his people, the people of Israel, and then for some reason or another, he jilted them. He dumped them. He chose a different system. That seems implausible. On the other hand, what does the new dispensation mean if the old one is still in place? And Christians really struggled with this. And so I think one of the sources of anti-Semitism is this problem of the fact that on the one hand, the Jews are where it all begins, and on the other hand, the Jews are in a sense the best argument against Christianity, because they're the ones who produced Christ, who was himself a Jew, but didn't acknowledge his messianic status. So there's this tremendous problem there that you have to deal with. And Christians struggle with this over the centuries. And there are different ways one can resolve the question. One could say, as Augustine did, for example, St. Augustine did, he said that, you know, the old covenant has not simply been rubbished and superseded. The Jews still have a place as witnesses to the old books, to the Mosaic Bible. And they, for that reason, it's okay to discriminate against them or to limit their numbers or to restrict their existence in various ways, but it's not okay to do away with them. God has something in store for them. And there was a long tradition of imagining, on the basis of various complex texts in the Bible, in particular Paul's letter to the Romans, that it might even be the case that a future conversion of the Jews to Christianity was prophesied, and that this conversion might bring about the triumphant conclusion of Christianity's journey through world history. On the other hand, there were those, and this became more and more dominant in the Middle Ages. In particular, it started in Spain and France with the mendicant orders, the Franciscans and the Dominicans, who started arguing, you know, who are these people who call themselves Jews? Are they really still the Jews of the Old Testament? Or are they just a sort of weird Oriental fragment of an ethnicity of some kind whose books no longer bear any resemblance to the Mosaic Bible? And there you have a lot of hostile attention to the Talmud, which is a book of Jewish scripture full of accumulated customary knowledge about the practice of Jewish religion. And hostile Christian observers and some converts from Judaism to Christianity subjected the Talmud to very antipathetic scrutiny and argued that it no longer had anything to do with that old covenant. And so these people were just strangers in our midst. That's where the complexity starts, if you like. And I think that is a unique situation.
You could say, the way you've described it, this is a problem in part about time or about history, as well as being about religion, and religion has its history too. The Jews are a historic people in that sense. They exist in the past. Their purpose, their meaning comes from their ancient status. And they also exist in the present. There are Jews now in the Middle Ages, in the early modern period. You know, the world has Jews in it. And the disappointment for Christians, in a way, with Jews and Judaism is it doesn't remain limited to its historic, ancient, traditional role. It evolves, it changes. And yet for it to make sense for Christians, it has to be contained. It has to be the before thing. These are the past people. These are the people who came before. So what are they doing existing in the present? Never mind, we'll come onto this in later versions. What are they doing thriving in the present? I don't think there was a huge amount of thriving in this period, but existing in the present. For Christians, the problem is a historic people who don't remain in history.
Yeah, they come from the past, but they don't stay in the past. And there's also a kind of Christian suspicion that there may be a role envisaged for them in the future. I mean, in his letter to the Romans, the Apostle Paul warns himself, a convert from Judaism, warns the non-Jewish Christians, the non-Jewish, the pagan converts to Christianity, not to denounce and despise the Jews, because he says, remember that the Jews are made of the wood of the original olive tree, of the first covenant. And so imagine when their wood is grafted back onto the tree, how it will flourish and what fruits it will bear. And this was interpreted, you know, I mean, the interpretations of this passage in the letter to the Romans are very diverse and people disagree about this and it goes on for centuries and centuries. But basically the question was, does this mean that the Jews are going to be put back onto the original tree? Is there going to be a restoration of the Jews, of Israel as a whole, to some kind of unity with Christianity? And if so, what role are they going to play in the future of Christianity? And people struggle with this. So on the one hand, as you say, they're a people of the past, but they refuse to stay in the past because they continue to exist and also to change and evolve in the present. But they're also a people of the future, I mean, in their own minds, but also in the minds of those around them. And what one of the most interesting things about the Jews, if you think about their place in Western Christian cultures, is that the way the Christians around them, the way the non-Jews around them use them to think about stuff. They use them to think about history. They use them to think about questions about what kind of journey Christianity is on through the world. And finally, most importantly, they use them to think about the end of the world. How is this going to finish off, this extraordinary story? When is the plan complete? And what will that completion look like? So they're kind of at the center of, you know, willy-nilly. I don't think they want to be at the center of everybody's thinking about these questions, but whether they want to be or not, they are. And so thinking with the Jews becomes one of the central habits of Christianity.
If you take someone like Luther, the originator of one strand of the Reformation, I don't think it's to trivialize it to say there's a kind of love-hate relationship here. And he changes. He was notoriously anti-Semitic, particularly towards the end. I mean, brutally, viciously anti-Semitic. And yet he also recognized the complete centrality of Judaism to his faith.
Absolutely. It is a love-hate relationship. I think that's not an unfair way of putting it. I mean, he envied the Jews. He taught himself Hebrew with enormous effort invested in that. He greatly esteemed the Jewish Bible, the Jewish scripture. He had a sort of reluctant admiration of rabbinical learning, although, of course, in his mind, rabbinical learning was admixed with all kinds of other heretical and irrelevant forms of knowledge about Jewish customary and religious life since the ancient period. But nevertheless, admiration and contempt were mixed up in a really unstable sort of compound in Luther. And he starts, you know, in the 1520s, full of a sense that perhaps the end of the world is already nigh, and the advent of a reform in the fabric of Western Christianity is going to bring about their conversion. That is his hope. And in that early hopeful phase, he publishes the famous essay, That Christ Was Born a Jew, Das Christus ein geborener Jude sei, in which he says, you know, let's not hit on the Jews. I mean, they are the cousins of Christ in the flesh. And he warns, reminds everyone of this and unfolds the consequences. But by the end of his life, in the 1520s, he's become an embittered old man, and he publishes horrendously hostile texts. I mean, one with the unpromising name of The Jews and Their Lies, in which, you know, he denounces them as stubborn, unconvertible, thick-necked. He says, let them be forced to take up tools and to plow the land. Let their synagogues be burned. Let their books be destroyed. And there's even worse stuff than that. Shem Hemphoras, for example, is an extraordinary text, full of just dripping with hatred. So it's a very complex story. And yet at the very end of his life, one of his last sermons, Luther once again returned to his hope for a restoration, a conversion of the Jews. So it's a very complex and unstable relationship. I think it's important, though, to remember this isn't just about theology. I mean, the Jews are also remarkable in other ways. They occupy a remarkable place in the societies and economies of the West. They have a unique occupational profile, and I think that's part of the mix as well.
Let's come on to that, but there is a question here about conversion that you just touched on there. I mean, in a way, if you are the Jews, if you are Jewish at this period, you can't win in the sense that, on the one hand, it's your job to bear witness, to be Jewish, that the point of being Jewish is that you aren't Christian. On the other hand, it's your job to convert.
Yeah, it's a tough nut to crack.
It's a tough nut to crack. You've got to be both converted and unconverted. And this persists right the way through. I mean, this is still going on in German theological politics, right the way through to the 18th, even the 19th century. The question, is it the job of Christian churches to convert the Jews? Or is it the job of Christian churches to recognize their difference? This isn't just a sort of medieval or 16th century or Reformation story. This isn't just part of a world in which, you know, the wars of religion that follow Luther, it was grim to be a Jew, but it was kind of grim to be anyone at various points, at various times. It was a genocidal world. But you go through the Enlightenment, and the echoes of this are still there.
I mean, I think the way you put it's very interesting, and it reveals that this is not just about theology, that on the one hand, the Jews are perceivable, they're discernible as Jews because they're separate, because they have some sort of separate existence that marks them off as Jewish, a particular style of clothing, for example, or dietary practices that differ from those of their neighbors. And a lot is made of that in contemporary discourses about the Jews throughout the Middle Ages and so on, especially about dietary practices. And so this is held against them, that they're cliquish and separate and not brotherly. They're not fraternal. They don't blend with the people around them. On the other hand, when they do start blending with the people around them, and what we now call assimilation, when they start assimilating and they cast aside these marks of separateness, well, then that's not good either. And they're accused of having sort of infiltrated the communities around them and no longer being discernible as Jews, but still in some sense wielding a nefarious, but now occult influence invisibly as Jews who are no longer recognizable as such. So again, it's yet another example of the paradoxical situation in which Jews find themselves, that they're damned if they do and they're damned if they don't.
Conversion, assimilation, part of the problem here is that it is tempting, and I think it was true of the conversion narrative as well as the assimilation narrative, to say that it's fake, right? So on the one hand, you want this people to convert to Christianity. On the other hand, because of your sense of their difference and their historic role, you kind of don't believe them when they do. But that then feeds into what is one of clearly the distinguishing features of the history of anti-Semitism, which is its propensity to collapse into a kind of paranoid conspiracy theorizing about the role of Jews in world history, which is a version of that assimilation story. Not to be assimilated is to be apart, and that's dubious. But to be assimilated, given that you are a people who are apart, is clearly to lead a kind of double life, or indeed to live a lie. And the echoes of the sort of 19th, even 20th century versions of that story are clearly there in the 16th, 17th century arguments about conversion. It's never stable because it's never satisfactory for the Christians, and it's never satisfactory because they don't quite believe their own story about the Jews.
That's right. This is another one of the paradoxes. The more pressure you put on the Jews to convert, the less likely it is that their conversions will be genuine. I mean, that's just obvious. So if you say to them, you can only stay in Spain if you convert to Christianity, otherwise we're going to drive you out and you have to go to some other place you know nothing of and live among strangers, then obviously you may well make a lot of converts, but their authenticity may not be the highest possible standard. So, and this again runs right through the whole history of this relationship with Jews and also the idea of their conversion or their absorption. Initially, it's a Christian translation into convert status. And in the case of Spain, in 1492, you have the expulsion of the Jews, but also the mass conversion by coercive means, and which include not just, you know, threatening people with violence, but also saying, you know, you can thrive and flourish and operate in any profession you choose if you just convert to Christianity. And this is going on not just in Spain, but elsewhere as well. But in Spain, no sooner have these very large numbers of Jews converted and become conversos, as they were called. But by the 1520s, the Spanish crown is starting to issue so-called estatutos de limpieza de sangre, these new statutes of the purity of blood, which are about distinguishing between people who are true Christians, old Christians, and people who are merely new Christians, who are seen as carrying a sort of germ of inauthenticity, which they've inherited from their Jewish forebears. And that's when you get something that looks a bit like a racial form of anti-Semitism, in the sense that this is an inheritable form of inauthenticity. It's a mark in the blood of the new Christians. So it's another example of the sort of paradoxes that anti-Semitism confronts the Jews with.
That Spanish narrative that you just described, it sort of reminds me of the way Romans thought about slaves and the obvious incoherence of the view in Roman law that, as, you know, because slaves were different, they weren't fully human. They couldn't be witnesses in a court of law unless the evidence had been tortured out of them, because torture was the mark that they were different. They couldn't just come forward like normal witnesses because you can't trust them. They're slaves. But at the same time, everyone knows that if you torture people, their evidence is unreliable because they'll say anything because they've been tortured. And it is one of those inevitable paradoxes of having a people that you both want to, you want to assimilate into your practices and customs, and you cannot treat them as being like you. But then if we take this story then into the Enlightenment and beyond, so the question of the Jews and their relationship to Christianity and to emerging secular political and cultural practices becomes, not just in Germany, but in Germany, something called the Jewish question. So it turns into, as you say, the Jews are used to think with and about. People try and work out who they are by thinking about what they think about the Jews. The Jewish question in late 18th, early 19th century Germany, what did people think the question was by this point? What was the question about the Jews? It was partly a question about citizenship and a particular version of assimilation, but why was there a Jewish question?
Well, the term the Jewish question is part of something that the American historian Holly Case has called the Age of Questions, when suddenly people were popping questions about everything. You know, there was the woman question, the Polish question, the Albanian question, the, you know, you name it. There was a question about almost everything. And there's something special about the 19th century that these questions suddenly have a capital Q and a capital whatever the other is, J or W, you name it. So, yeah, the 19th century sees the proliferation of these questions. And, of course, these questions are themselves bundles of questions. And the Jewish question is a bundle of different questions, as you were just suggesting. You know, it's partly about processes of emancipation and assimilation, the absorption of Jews into the Christian majority. It's about the nature of citizenship. Should citizenship, this is a question that really moves people and interests people in the late 18th century, should citizenship be religiously marked? Is it okay to be a non-Christian citizen of a state like France or of a state like the Kingdom of Prussia, for example? But then there's also the question of the socioeconomic profile of the Jews, which is also one of the central themes of anti-Semitic discourses in the late 18th and especially coming into the 19th century as it becomes a big issue. The question of the location of the Jews as occupying a special relationship, for example, with processes of credit, the issuing of credit, the lending of money, the role of Jews as what I would call marginal capitalists. I mean, this is one of the most, again, I keep on having to reach for the sort of metaphor of paradox, but, you know, it's the fact that for centuries, the Jews had been driven out, on the one hand, of land ownership. Nobody wanted a Jewish peasantry. They didn't want the Jews to own land because that was the single most prestigious form of ownership there was. So land should be in Christian hands. Gilded labor, the gilded skilled labor of people who made beautiful things like shirts and shoes and all that kind of thing, that was under the control of Christian guilds, which had chapels and funeral services and all the rest of it, and so which were religious institutions and also kept Jews out. So if you're driven out of manufacturing and you're not allowed to own land, that leaves, and there are many other restrictions besides, that pushed the Jews into, among other things, you know, the sale and secondhand goods, transitory forms of salesmanship, wandering around in the countryside. The traveling Jew was a part of the sort of landscape of European societies in the 18th century, but it also meant a concentration in money lending and processes of offering credit. And this in a world where there didn't exist credit institutes which were willing to lend money to vulnerable clients like peasants or like shoemakers in a small town in central Germany. And that meant that the Jews who had been forced into this kind of cash economy that nobody else wanted to be in find themselves in a position that evolves over time of privilege. And it's in that connection that they get associated with the idea of usury. People say these guys are charging interest, it's too much, they're sucking us dry, and so on. But of course, the problem with the term usury is that interest rates are there to protect the person lending the money from the possible loss of his principal, among other things. And if you're lending to very vulnerable clients, like, for example, rural people in central Germany in the 18th century, you will charge a higher interest rate in order to cover for those, to hedge for those risks. And the interest rate is simply what the market will bear. Nobody's putting a gun to these people's heads and saying, you must borrow money. But if they need the money, they will pay that rate if they need it enough. So that's how it operates. And the moneylender, whether he's Jewish or not, and this is something you can observe in other cultures, is not a very popular person when things go belly up. When there's suddenly a tightening and people, their farms are foreclosed or they can't repay their debts, suddenly everybody's attention, everybody's beady eyes are fixed on the moneylender. And so that becomes another reason for hating the Jews. You don't want to pay them back. You want to destroy their debt records and so on. So that becomes also part of the discourse of anti-Semitism, this special relationship between the Jews and money, even though, of course, on the other hand, you need the Jewish moneylender. So there is the same ambivalence. People would talk in a German village, they would say, we need some money, we'll have to go to the Jew. On the other hand, that was a very precarious situation for the moneylender to be in. If he's living in a rural environment where his legitimacy is in question, his stranger status remains, and he's not really protected by law or social norms.
And by the early or mid-19th century, can you start to see the coming together of two versions of this? Because this is also the era where the Rothschilds are funding the Napoleonic Wars. You know, there is the village moneylender in Central Europe version, and there is the capitals of Europe and money lending on a really grand scale to sovereigns and others.
I'm so glad you mentioned the Rothschilds because, you know, of course, they loom very, very large in the discourse, in the imaginary, as it were, of anti-Semitism in 19th century Europe. They're absolutely huge. But, of course, they are just the sort of modern example of a phenomenon which was actually very old and extends back into the Middle Ages, the phenomenon of the court Jew or of the Jewish factor, the Jewish financier or someone with accounting and financial skills who's been pulled close to government, to people who hold power, and is used to raise money to wage wars or to get princes out of debt and so on. And these highly placed but extremely precarious people become great figures in the narrative of Jewish history. I mean, and when I say precarious, I mean that, you know, when things went bad, they could be taken to trial. And there's a famous example of the man known as Yud Zeus, a figure who haunts Nazi propaganda in the period of the Third Reich, an early modern Jewish financier who was turned against by the government that had actually been using his services and tortured and eventually executed in the most horrible way. So, you know, these people are both powerful and very, very vulnerable.
And the link that's made, and it is made, and it was certainly made in the 20th century, the Jews, many Jews in Europe are extremely poor and vulnerable in the ways that the poor are vulnerable. And what you described...
That's a really important point. I remember when I was an undergraduate at Sydney University, there was a very charismatic lecturer called Bob Dreyer. And he used to say, you know, we need a history of the stupid Jew. We need a history of the poor, dumb Jew, the schlemiel and the schmuck, and so on. So, and he was absolutely right. I mean, there is a great and untold history of the not very talented, not very well endowed and Jew who doesn't know about the refinements of credit and finance and so on, and is just a street porter or a laborer or working on the docks or whatever. There are countless Jews in that situation. And of course, they get lost from view because our attention is so tightly focused on these key figures.
But how, as you move through the 19th century, does that version of anti-Semitism, which focuses on Jewish power, Jewish influence, as you say, it's vulnerable, it's always been vulnerable, and it's also, it's not a new invention of the 19th century. But how does that get collapsed into this wider racial anti-Semitism, which after all, in the end, comes for not, I mean, it comes for everyone in the end, but it crucially comes for the impoverished, the marginalized, the Jews who have always lived on the edge of society. How do the two get collapsed together? Because it is one of the puzzles about anti-Semitism, that it does run together, the fact that the Jews are viewed as uniquely powerful, often in a conspiratorial way, and also vulnerable outsiders.
Absolutely. I think one of the key factors here is, and there's, again, sorry about this, but it's a paradox again, but once the promise of emancipation dawns, once people start to, for example, just to give an example from an area that I know a little bit about, Prussia, in 1812, the government gets around to saying, okay, look, we need to recognize Jews on an equal footing with their Christian co-citizens. And so an edict of emancipation is issued, which states that the Jews are citizens of the state and Inländer, in other words, not Ausländer, they're not foreigners, they're natives. So they're declared to be natives and citizens of the state. Incidentally, and this is an interesting thing, the Jews are the only citizens of the state. This term is not being used about anybody else. Everybody else is just Prussian subjects or whatever. But the first citizens of the state are the Jews. And this is supposed to disconnect their citizenship from their religious status. They're citizens regardless of their creed. Now, this is still a limited offer in the sense that they can't occupy political office. They can't wield authority over Christians. This means they can't, for example, ascend through the ranks of the military. But they are at least, you know, they're no longer subject to the special negative privileges, the special jurisdictions that burdened Jews in Ancien Régime Europe. So it's the end of a long history of a particular kind of discrimination. But there's a pushback. As soon as people say the Jews are no longer separate, they're one of us, they are us, they're the same, then the question arises, well, are they really? And if that's so, perhaps we need to think again about what the state is for. Is the state really a completely religiously indifferent institution? Do we want to have Jewish judges presiding over divorce trials, for example, which might involve the breach of a sacrament, a Christian sacrament? What do we do about protecting the Christian legacies latent in the state structure from the involvement of Jews in public offices? And that's one of the reasons why these emancipation edicts often make limitations, stipulate limitations. And then you have the fact that, you know, once the Jews are no longer separate, the question then arises of what to do about their special economic standing, the alleged place of the Jews in credit, in the processes of early capitalism, and so on. And it's interesting that in 1848, for example, when there are a lot of pieces of emancipatory legislation, that, especially in the German states, but right across Europe, one of the consequences of that is that someone like Richard Wagner, who's very much involved in the 1848, 1849 revolutions, then writes an essay in 1850 in which he says, I'm sick and tired of hearing these calls for the emancipation of the Jews. What we need is the emancipation from the Jews, because the king of creditors has now become the king of the credulous. And, you know, we're in danger of becoming the sort of serfs, the subjects of this new Jewish money power. So in some ways, the, you know, emancipation, though it brings relief for Jews in many respects, though incidentally, and this is another very interesting subject, it divides Jews. I mean, it divides Jewish communities. Not all Jews want to be emancipated in that sense. And Jews face They don't like the idea of having to give up their specialness, and one can well understand why. So it cuts across these communities, but even the promise of relief in the form of emancipation then immediately produces a pushback.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Is there still a kind of eschatological streak to this? What you just described, so revolutionary politics can be pretty eschatological. It can have a kind of end of times quality to it. And it still sounds like, if you're talking about Wagner there, it still sounds like that the Jews are being used to symbolize a certain kind of all or nothing. Politics seems like too weak a word for it. All or nothing historical understanding, that something about the Jews is there to symbolize whether we are, we are at the hinge of history. A lot of people believed 1848 was a hinge of history. Maybe it was, maybe it wasn't. But revolutions can feel like that. And the Jews are still getting caught up in this in the way they were centuries before, as the people through whom you try and understand how high the stakes are. It's extraordinary in a way, given, as we said, most European Jews were just on the receiving end of all of this.
Yeah, what's remarkable is that people are still thinking with the Jews, and they're using the Jews to think, for example, about what capitalism is. What are the modern institutions of credit? The more refined operations of credit are viewed with suspicion in many quarters of society, and anti-Semitism is one way of articulating a kind of ambivalence or even antipathy to capitalism, to modern credit institutions, and so on, and to structures of exploitation. Even Marx, who's himself of Jewish ancestry, connects, uses, in a sense, anti-Semitism in order to prize apart the assumptions that make capitalism work. So they're still playing this role, whether they want to or not, of being used as tokens for thinking about the stuff that people worry about most. And that's obviously a rather perilous position to be in. I think that the point you made about eschatology is interesting, because it is still, in a way, about all or nothing. It's about, are we going to wind up having all of the valuable, and this is the kind of language anti-Semites would use in the 19th century, is everything sort of green and lush and valuable in life going to be sucked out of us by capitalists, for which Jewish capitalists? Or is there going to be some kind of, fight back? And are we going in the end to win? Is Jesus going to win? Or, soulless moneylenders going to drive us the way of, drive us to hell in a handbasket? So it's always this kind of either or, and it's always about ultimate outcomes, ultimate states. And that's another one of the perils of being Jewish in the era of 19th century anti-Semitism, namely that, it's about all or nothing and everything depends on them.
And as this then morphs into Nazi anti-Semitism, I mean, this is a big question. I don't know if it's an answerable question, but is the fascist version of this recognizably drawing on this body of thoughts and prejudices and fears, so you can hear the echoes? Or when you look at the, fascism is itself, Nazism is an eschatological movement too. When you look at the versions of these arguments in the 20s and 30s and where they led to, is it a mistake to see this as part of a single history? Was there a break? Was there something qualitatively different about the Hitler version?
I mean, I think there are breaks all the way along and there are inflection points. And, you know, there's another way of telling the history of anti-Semitism, which is to think of it as, because there have obviously been long periods which are not particularly crisis prone. And, you know, you can think of it in terms of disruptions and moments of inflection points and moments of change and so on. So that would mean looking at something like the first the Crusades, for example, would produce a massive deterioration in the sort of safety or a massive surge in the precarity of Jewish life in Western Europe and create this massive buildup of Jews in Central Europe as they flee from the West into what will become the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth. And then there would be the Black Death is another difficult moment. Then the Reformation is obviously in many ways a transformative moment and so on and so forth. But I think that there are continuities. I mean, one way one could think about this is that, you know, one way of summarizing Paul's promise that the Jews would be restored to Christianity, as he put it, the fullness of, in the English translation, the fullness of Israel is not yet gone in. And when the fullness of Israel was going to go in, the promise was sometimes summarized in the words, you know, the Jews are our salvation. Die Juden sind unser Heil. That was one way of thinking about this future conversion of the Jews. But then you have Treitschke, the anti-Semitic historian, using the words, die Juden sind unser Unheil. They are our unsalvation. They are not our salvation. They're not our redemption. They are our perdition. Now, that is the precise inversion from hope to dread. It's still apocalyptic. It's still about eschatology. It's still about the doctrine of the last things. But this time it's not going to end well. It's going to end in disaster. What's common in the two positions is that it's going to be the Jews who are pivotal to this story. And that, I think, is interesting. And you see in the transition to Nazism, I mean, Nazism is special against that longer background because Nazism scientizes anti-Semitism. There's a very good book about this by Michael Burley and Wolfgang Wippermann called The Racial State, in which they point out that Nazism melds together the sciencyness of eugenics with the very unsciencey quality of anti-Semitism, which was traditionally about, you know, having killed Jesus, or, you know, it was sociological. It was about being involved with capital or being a moneylender or being exploitative or whatever. You put these things together and you end up with something like National Socialist style anti-Semitism, an eradicable racial contamination.
And yet the stakes are all or nothing. In fact, I don't know why I say and yet. In a sense, the logic of that is almost to raise the stakes. I mean, you have something that was already eschatological, but now you've injected it with not science, as you say, but a kind of sciencey 20th century understanding, which, apart from anything else, raises the possibility that there is a, you know, and this is the word, right? There is a solution to the Jewish question.
Well, exactly. I mean, the whole idea of a final solution, Endlösung, which is, of course, only one of the many eschatological end times terms that the Nazis trafficked with, you know, Endkampf, Endsieg, you know, the final victory, the final struggle, the final solution. It was all about this finality, this final state of affairs. And Hitler's writing and imagination are organized to an extraordinary extent around this anticipation of a final state of affairs. So yes, it is still all or nothing. And in fact, in Mein Kampf, Hitler links the defeat of Germany in the First World War, his understanding that Germany had lost and his grief at that discovery, at that understanding, with his hatred of the Jews. At least retrospectively, he connects it. And he says, you know, and then I realized there can be no negotiating with the Jew. There is only all or nothing, the brutal all or nothing, Entweder oder. So, you know, it really is a massive intensification. And in some respects, you know, a transition. And I think we should take seriously this change in quality and intensity, because if you go back in history to the, you know, let's say to the late 19th century, the 1880s and 90s, and you asked an intelligent contemporary, European contemporary, who was well informed about the conditions across Europe, and you said, you know, there's going to be a tremendous, you know, massacre of the Jews, a tremendous killing off. Where do you think this will happen? Nobody would have said Germany. People would have said Russia was the most likely place where this would happen, because there was an extremely virulent anti-Semitism there and frequent pogroms and terrible violence against the Jews in 1903 and again in 1905. And there was the Dreyfus Affair in France, you know, really virulent anti-Semitism and lots of anti-Semitic journals and public discourse and so on. So people might have said France. They probably wouldn't have said Germany, where there was a very impressive sort of almost Spanish-style symbiosis of Jews and Germans had produced, you know, a really extraordinary cultural and technical and scientific flowering across the German states. Nevertheless, this transition did come about largely in the context of the deep disturbance caused by defeat in the First World War and the political disturbances that followed. And Germany then embarks on this, I mean, initially in the form of fairly loosely organized right-wing networks, and then the National Socialists who, you know, gather together a lot of these rather scattered splinter groups. And then eventually, of course, the imposition of National Socialist power on Germany after 1933. And then, of course, you do get something that is completely unique, even against the background of this terrible history, rich in traumata, something which has no precedent, you know, expressed in the creation of purpose-designed killing facilities, for example. I mean, that's not all of the Holocaust happens in those facilities. There's a book called Holocaust by Bullet, which is about the enormous numbers of people who are simply shot and killed in various more traditional ways. But I think that truly, if you really want, you know, to capture the essence of what's unique about the Holocaust, it is those purpose-designed killing centers in the sort of system known as Operation Reinhardt, named for Reinhard Heydrich, the sort of sidekick of Heinrich Himmler, assassinated in Czechoslovakia. And in his memory, this thing was known as Operation Heinrich. The camps called Sobibor, Treblinka, Belzec, and Chełmno, and so on, which existed solely for killing. People turned up, they were killed, they were disposed of, more people turned up, and so on. And there's never been anything remotely like that.
I hesitate to ask this question, but I think it does come out of what we were talking about earlier. Is there a relationship between the totality of what happened in Germany, particularly after 1939, and what you just described there, which was the preceding symbiosis, the, as it were, the success of the coming together of Jewish life and Christian life in Germany? That is there a relationship between the success of the integration and then when the reaction comes? Unlike, say, in Russia, where there was no successful integration, when the reaction comes, there is something totalizing about the reaction. It sort of has to undo everything.
Yeah, that's a really interesting thought. I mean, if you think about, you know, where are the two great catastrophes of Jewish life? I mean, there are many catastrophes, obviously, and we're approaching, well, in the midst of Passover right now. And of course, part of the liturgy of Passover is the acknowledgement that there's been an enemy, you know, a threat to every generation. But if we think, where are the two great existential catastrophes? There would be, I think, Spain and Germany. And both of those places were the location of a remarkable flowering of Jewish, Spanish, Sephardic, and later of Judeo-German culture and civilization. I mean, and the loss of the Jews, you know, destroyed Germany's standing worldwide intellectually. It ruined German science. It turned the German universities from absolutely leading international institutions that everybody wanted to go to into backwaters. So it was a remarkable episode. It was a remarkable achievement of, you know, combined efforts and mutual understanding and rapprochement. And I think you're right that there must be a relationship between the violence of the conclusion of this episode and the density and intricacy of the interactions that had preceded it.
So if we bring this story up closer to, or maybe right the way up to the present, I'm sure people listening to this will hear echoes in the description that you've given about Jewishness standing in sometimes as a proxy for capitalism in contemporary anti-Semitism. The Rothschilds then, the Rothschilds now. I mean, some features of anti-Semitism are creepily persistent in their details, right? You can find a sort of Rothschilds-based conspiracy theory across almost any period of the last 200 years right up to 2024.
Yes, it's very interesting in that connection, actually, to think that, you know, I think we should also think briefly about where are the situations in which Jews have not faced this kind of threat, because there are plenty of those as well. And one interesting thing is that they tended not to face threat in highly commercialized societies, where the Jews are not pushed into a situation where they are the only ones or they are specialists in a particular form of credit transaction, but where there already exists an entire sector of society. So, for example, the Netherlands, a highly commercialized society, never developed powerful native forms of anti-Semitism. I mean, there's some Dutch anti-Semitism history of the Netherlands, obviously, but it's not a salient feature of that society. Britain is another case in point, although Britain had in the Middle Ages been a place of virulent anti-Judaism, at least, in the modern era, as a highly commercialized culture, which looked fondly on banks and commercial transactions, the Jews didn't stand out in that way. And the United States would be another example. Yeah. So if you have sophisticated commercial societies where people are used to this kind of thing and don't think it's amazing if someone wants to be paid for lending you money, you know, then the Jews are probably going to be okay. It's in places where that is not the case that they become the tokens for hatred of a particular kind of allegedly exploitative transaction.
But it's also the case that those recognizable features have gone along with a persistent use of the Jews. I don't know any other word to call it than that, for thinking through end of times politics as well. And some of this does focus on the state of Israel. I mean, we can't, in what remains of this podcast, talk about how to understand the state of Israel. But there is, I think, unquestionably some echo of some of what you described in the way people through to the 21st century think about Israel, which is both the special state, you know, some of the circumstances of its origin make it unique, including coming after the Holocaust. It's a state that for many people belongs in a particular time in history. You know, there is among many people now a nostalgia for a previous version of the Jewish state, which is only a couple of generations ago, but the kind of socialist kibbutz version of Israel. And Israel is blamed for having evolved and having, you know, as it were, escaped its historical origins. And Israel both plays the role as the special state and the state that provokes understandable rage and fury because it just behaves like any other state, sometimes worse than many other states. It's a brutal state. It's a state. You know, it's not just the Jewish state. It's a state.
Yeah, with an army, a navy, and an air force.
Yeah, you hear that kind of doubleness in the way people talk about or think about Israel, you know, that sort of uncertainty as to whether Israel is or is not a state apart. And it's fueled in part by the rhetoric of the Israeli state, which also plays on this in the sense that, you know, one does often hear that Israel is a state apart. And yet, in many respects, Israel is a recognizable and sometimes brutal modern state.
Yes. And I mean, no one can feel anything but horror at the, you know, video feeds we get of the events taking place in Gaza. But I think that it's complicated. And, you know, I can already feel myself, you know, my temperature going up half a degree just as I enter into this domain, because we're dealing with a domain in which emotions are flowing in every direction. People are very upset about this. There's anger. There's a sense of, you know, grief and outrage. And these feelings need to be taken seriously. There's also the grief and outrage of Israelis at the enormities committed by Hamas and of also of Jews around the world and of people sympathetic with the state of Israel. So, you know, it's a very complex domain to tread on. I think that myself that, you know, doubtless discourses about Israel are in some respects implicated in the history of anti-Semitic discourses, that history is not dead and that it's still alive in parts of the world of what is said about Israel. But I must say that I'm not sure that it's very helpful to deploy the term anti-Semitism in discussing the Israel-Gaza conflict at the moment. There's a lot of outrage about what's going on. I understand that. And I'm just as horrified by what I see on my television screens as everybody else is. I think that it's not anti-Semitic to be upset by the extremist theocratic turn that this particular Israeli government has taken in recent years. I don't think that's anti-Semitic. I don't think it's anti-Semitic to be upset or even angry on behalf of the Gazans and in the face of what they're suffering. What interests me is the pattern of attention. People who are very, very aroused about Gaza were not at all aroused about the hundreds of thousands who've died in the Yemen conflict, for example, or the 500,000 Syrians who've perished in exactly the same way, in houses that have been smashed by bombs, and of course, babies, women, children, you name it, civilians of all kinds. So what's going on there? And I don't think it is anti-Semitism, but I think it is a sort of remnant of a sort of lensing of our attention around what for many people is still the Holy Land. It's still perhaps part of a habit of over-expectations of Israel, a hypersensitivity to what Israel does. And so a tendency to assign kind of world historical significance to a conflict that is deadly and brutal and terrible, but no more deadly and brutal and terrible than other conflicts that are happening not a million miles away. So I think that it's probably true that while this is not about anti-Semitism, that there are bits of submerged eschatological reasoning. They're not present as consciously religious arguments, otherwise secular people wouldn't use them. But they're bobbing around there in the discourse. And that is what I think is interesting. They operate in this way precisely because they're not recognized as such.
And even among secular people, this is quite an eschatological age that we're living in. It's a millenarian age, and maybe with good rational secular reasons behind it. This is an incredibly dangerous world. There are many existential risks. People talk about the end of humanity, the end of the species, in a way that would have been familiar 7 or 8 centuries ago, but less familiar, I think, in the 19th century. The risks, the stakes are enormously high. And it does sometimes feel like the focus, the lensing, as you called it, on this, is partly because of the story that you've been telling here of a people who are perceived as both uniquely vulnerable and uniquely powerful. You know, that double quality, which has been part of the history of non-Jewish thinking about the Jews, you can still hear echoes of it. The heightened emotion that there is around the state of Israel is partly engendered by that sense that one is being asked to think about and to believe two things that are quite hard to hold together, that this is a unique state and it's like any other state. This is a uniquely vulnerable state. It's also not uniquely powerful, but it's a pretty damn powerful state. And I certainly, in the story that you told earlier, hear the deep, submerged, you know, not explicitly religious echoes in the way that, as you say, this conflict focuses the attention not just of the Jewish world, but the non-Jewish world.
Yes, and we're still thinking with the Jews. This conflict prompts us to think about, you know, colonial structures, the history of imperialism, the relationship between the West and the non-West. It's still working. It's still an instrument for thinking about the largest problems we have in the world today. And this has been part of the predicament of the Jews from the beginning.
There will be more from Chris Clark, not in this series, but in a series that we're going to be recording soon and putting out later this summer, about the big historical counterfactuals, the what-ifs of political history. And I'm going to be talking to Chris, among other things, about the big what-ifs of 1914. If you would like to subscribe to Past, Present, Future Plus to get bonus episodes and ad-free listening, and that will include 2 bonus bad ideas to accompany this series, just go to ppfideas.com or click on the link that you'll find with the show description that comes with this episode. Next time on The History of Bad Ideas, we're talking again to Adam Rutherford, and he's going to be explaining why taxonomy, which sounds pretty innocuous, isn't. Why ordering the natural world is a really bad idea. This has been Past, Present, Future, brought to you in partnership with the London Review of Books.
The softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.